There are things in the universe billions of years older than either of our races. They are vast, timeless. And if they are aware of us at all, it is as little more than ants. And we have as much chance of communicating with them as an ant has with us.
We know. We've tried.
And we've learned that we can either stay out from underfoot or be stepped on. They are a mystery. And I am both terrified and reassured to know that there are still wonders in the universe that we have not yet explained everything.
Welcome to Pot, a podcast where you can learn about and relive some of the best that entertainment has to offer. We'll revisit some of our favorite films, music, and media that helped influence and shape our lives. Sit back, strap in, and keep your arms and legs inside the vehicle at all times. Here are your hosts, Daniel and Ben.
And Tanya.
On February 2nd, 1993, the landscape of science fiction television was forever altered by a new show that would redefine the storytelling process.
Joseph Michael Straczynski, known to fans as JMS, decided that many shows that went over budget and got canceled did so due to a lack of planning.
To fix this, he wrote a story with a fully thought-out five-year arc. To prevent having to shoot on location, it was set aboard a space station located in neutral territory.
The station was crewed by Earth military and representatives from many different alien races as a sort of United Nations in space where they could work to resolve their differences. Many of these races had recently been at war, ratcheting up the tension immediately as the show began.
Before this, no other science fiction series had attempted an ongoing episodic storyline. Every series from Star Trek to Lost in Space had what Joe called a reset button.
No matter what growth a character had or truths discovered, everything magically reset by the next episode.
JMS had five goals in mind at the outset. The show would not only have to be good science fiction, it would also have to be good television. A combination rare for the genre, emphasizing individual storylines over a larger backdrop. It needed to be reasonably budgeted, and it would have to look unlike anything ever seen before on television.
He would involve other creative minds in the writing process, such as Peter David, Neil Gaiman, Catherine M. Drennan, Lawrence DiTillo, DC Fontana, David Gerald, and Harlan Ellison as a creative consultant.
To deal with the reality that actors might not always be available, leave for other series, or even pass away, JMS wrote in what he called trapdoors for every character. This made it possible to replace an actor with little disruption to the ongoing storyline.
The show appeared on the Primetime Entertainment Network, owned by Warner Brothers, referred to more commonly as P10.
In the show's fourth season, Warner Communications shut down P10, leaving the series' fifth and final season in doubt.
Turner Network Television came to the rescue by commissioning two Babylon 5 made-for-television films. Ultimately, TNT picked up the series, and JMS was able to hire back most of the actors to film the fifth and final season.
The series was nominated for 8 Emmys and won 2, won 3 Hugo Awards, a Saturn Award, 2 Space Frontier Awards, and an E Pluribus Unum Award.
This is the Interstellar News Network reporting from the Epsilon Eridani Quadrant. The year is 2257. The name of the place is Babylon 5. Hello, everybody. He's Daniel.
That's Ben.
And I'm still Tanya. Yep, that's me.
Today we're going to discuss Babylon 5, which, in my opinion, is one of the finest television series of my lifetime.
Babylon 5 ran 5 seasons, had 4 made-for-TV movies, 1 spinoff, and 1 pilot that sadly fell short of selling a new series.
Within the last couple of weeks, it was announced that there would be a reboot in the making for the CW, a subsidiary of Warner Brothers.
To that end, this episode will focus on the original release, though we will definitely give our thoughts on the reboot during our show.
As there will be new fans seeking out information about Babylon 5 thanks to the reboot, We will be talking about the show without spoilers for this episode.
We would not want to steal your joy, dear listeners. But our second episode, which should go live about 2 weeks following this one, will be an in-depth discussion of the major plot points, character arcs, and influence that this series had on the genre, fans, and other television shows going forward. Spoilers will abound.
We were extremely fortunate to land an interview with Julie Caitlin Brown, who played Natoth, and our discussion with her will be in the second half of this episode. Since there are spoilers revealed in the interview, we recommend pausing this episode at that point if you're planning on watching Babylon 5 and then getting back to the podcast after you've done so. Let's talk about Babylon 5.
Babylon 5!
Babylon 5, yeah. Let's briefly discuss the pilot, The Gathering. I don't want to go too heavily into it because it was really only made to sell the series. There's some important things that happen in it, but you can kind of get away with not having to watch it.
That's true.
Yeah, you pretty much can.
What do you guys recall from the pilot? And remember, we're trying to keep this spoiler free. So anything that happened in the pilot, because most people, I would think, are going to skip the pilot. I don't know.
They might not. There are people who operate with a completionist mindset. If it exists, they want to experience it. So I think plenty of people will watch the pilot, even if we tell them, look, you can really get away without it.
Yeah. My recommendation would be not to watch the pilot. In fact, everybody that I've introduced the series to, I've always started them at episode one, because the pilot to me is not great. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah. I will say I didn't hate it. Like, I remember when it first came out on TV and I had recorded it. And I think the reason that I may have done it is that Lita Alexander, Pat Talman, was in the Night of the Living Dead remake. She was the heroine. And I loved her. And I was like, oh my God, it's sci-fi and she's in it. That's super cool. But I don't know. You could see that there was potential in the story, which I literally still have the VHS that I recorded the pilot on.
I agree. There's definitely plenty of potential. And Pat Talman, you're right. She's amazing. Night of the Living Dead. She was in Star Trek. She's a stunt woman. She did mostly stunt work before this. So this was kind of a new thing for her. As much as I love Pat Talman, especially as the series goes on, she becomes absolutely amazing. This pilot, not so much my favorite bit of her work. And fortunately,
well, and it's not even her. I think it's every actor in the pilot, because that point, and I would say even season one to a large extent, the same thing, at least the beginning, because I feel like people are really trying to find their footing and figure out their characters. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't feel as engrossing as it does as the series progresses.
Well, I agree with that. One of the things I would say is that in the pilot, though, only two characters are fleshed out at all. And that's Mallari and Sinclair. Everybody else is sort of a afterthought. They're there. They are part of the story, but you learn nothing about them. And to me, I get it. You're trying to sell the show. So you're going to focus on the hero. And you're also going to focus on this Mallari character, you know, who is kind of a sad sack in the pilot.
Yeah.
The great Centauri Empire, open Earth hours, 9 to 5, right? It was a good pilot. It just, there's so many reasons it falls short for me. And one of them is directing. It's not JMS directing this. They hired this guy in to direct it. And he tried to go all Blade Runner with the lighting. I don't know if you noticed, but it's dark. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look like the rest of the series at all. And it was horribly miscast, you know, especially for people that are coming in and are supposed to be a certain type of character. Even though I like the actress in other things, I'm not saying she's a bad actress elsewhere, but she was terribly miscast. And it was Tamlin Tamita as Takashima. It just didn't work. And we're supposed to believe her as a military commander. And I didn't. I didn't buy it. The delivery was wrong. It almost felt like she didn't want to be there. I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
I did feel like she was out of place. I didn't get a particular sense of whether or not she wanted to be there. So I'll go along with what you perceived there. But it didn't seem like she felt comfortable with the role she was playing.
Yeah. I think her eventual replacement kind of speaks to that too. You also had Andreas Katsoulas' Jakar in the pilot. In my opinion, he's one of the finer actors on this show, but he was so one-dimensional. If they could have given him a little twirly mustache to like twirl as he spoke, you know?
Yes.
So it just, the pilot to me, when I want somebody to watch a show, and I just did this recently, I had my girlfriend, who is not a big science fiction fan, sat her down to watch Babylon 5, and it took me a while to convince her to even sit down and watch it. I skipped the pilot, and there was a reason, and I'm glad I did.
Yes.
So, do you guys have any other points on this pilot?
I did. I noticed in just my own internal reaction when I went to begin reviewing the series in preparation for this, I went and rewatched, started with the pilot, got finished with the pilot, and found I just wanted to do something else rather than roll right into watching the episodes.
Right.
I actually felt a little bit sort of discouraged from watching the rest. But ultimately I remembered, no, wait a minute. I binged the heck out of this thing when I first watched it 10 years ago because I enjoyed it so much. So I need to keep going with this. But yeah, my response to the pilot was not favorable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in truth, there's nothing that you're going to glean from what goes on in the pilot that you don't learn in the rest of the series anyway. Yeah. In fact, they did some wonky things. And Tanya, I know you had mentioned to me, aside from this, that you had the original recording that aired on P10. You have the actual before yep. TNT changed the beginning.
Yep. I have, like, yeah, it's old and dusty in a box somewhere.
Right. And there's TNT, in my opinion, committed a cardinal sin because they put a spoiler in the very beginning of that episode. I'm not going to say what it is, and I hope people that don't like spoilers would avoid watching that because of it. So,
yeah, that's so funny because I remember when you had gotten, I think you'd gotten the DVDs, and I was over at your place and we watched that episode and we looked at each other and we're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then that night I went home and busted out my videotape and put it in. And I was like, I went with my brother and I was like, oh my God, you have to come look at this. Oh my gosh, look what they did. We never noticed. And it wasn't in there. So,
yeah. So for people listening and wondering what the heck we're talking about, it's just, there was a major spoiler in the TNT version of the pilot that wasn't in the original release. So if you don't like spoilers, you don't want major things ruined for you, I'd avoid watching that pilot personally, and just move on to episode one. That's my recommendation. I don't know if you guys feel the same way.
Yeah, I concur.
Yeah, I agree. You're not going to miss anything that you need.
It's pretty amazing that the show got picked up. It went through so much just to get that pilot made. Straczynski had to sell this idea and then on a shoestring budget put together this series. The show itself was filmed in an abandoned hot tub warehouse. There was not a professional studio lot, anything like that. If you listen to any of the actors' interviews, they always talk about this, you know, especially if they came from shooting Trek on the Paramount lot, right? Where they've got their own personal trailers and their assistants, and there's, you know, these craft service, all this great stuff. And then they show up Babylon 5, they drive into this little parking lot of an abandoned hot tub place, and they go inside and end up shooting a day inside this crazy location.
That is amazing.
It's amazing the budget they had to work with. And they were using CGI special effects that were landmark at the time, but today they call them the toasters, right? They were done on these little Amiga computers, and it took hours and hours and hours to create a very small section of special effects. And as the series goes on and you see some of these special effects, it's quite amazing because they got better as the show went on. But I still think looking at it, even though if you compare it to today, it doesn't really compare. But for the time, it's quite amazing what they were able to accomplish with special effects.
They did a good job with that.
That's true. Well, and I loved the costuming. I loved the makeup. The special effects makeup for the aliens was really, really well done. Probably some of the better that I've seen, at least for that time period.
We're all Star Trek fans, right? Everybody here?
Yes.
I know I am. That was a big difference between Babylon 5 and Star Trek. The aliens were truly alien. It wasn't just some dude with the bumps on his forehead. The aliens had full prosthetics in some cases. You had Ambassador Kosh, one of the coolest aliens ever.
Understanding is a three-edged sword.
And he was in this encounter suit that looks like, I don't know, like a curtain. Looks like a Mr. Coffee with a curtain on the bottom of it. Walking around and very cryptic.
You have always been here.
I don't know, Kosh is pretty freaking awesome. But the costuming was good, and the aliens were fantastic. As far as the look of the show, I mean, you can't really knock much of it. There were spots where you could tell it was done with a budget. Sometimes when they're standing in CNC and, you know, command and control, they're talking to each other, and you can see that that space outside was probably supposed to be a special effect, but it looked like just a blackboard with holes poked in it for stars. I was talking about how much they had to go through just to get the show on the air. And I'm not going to go in heavily on it, because if you want to learn what JMS went through just to get this show sold, I'm going to plug his book, because his book is phenomenal. It's called Becoming Superman. And since I don't have a whole lot of time to read, and my eyesight's not that great anymore, I went on Audible. And apparently, because I have a Prime account on Amazon, I get free credits every month. And I decided, hey, you know what? I'm going to finally check this book out. And I say now that I've read it, even though I listened to it. Peter Jurisic, who plays Londo, reads it. And I can't tell you how moving and amazing this essentially autobiography is. There were points where I was in tears, and I was listening at work. I had to excuse myself from the floor at work to go in the bathroom and wipe my eyes, because it was just that good. He went through a monstrous childhood, was essentially unloved as a human being for a good part of his life, or at least felt unloved. And how he came out of that and was able to become the prolific writer and person that he is today is an amazing, inspiring, and compelling story. And if you want to learn about the man who wrote this fantastic series, I can't recommend it more. So yeah, check out Becoming Superman by Joseph Michael Straczynski. So on that note, I had to plug it. Sorry, guys. It was one of those great books. But let's talk about the very first time you saw Babylon 5 and what you recall. Tanya, why don't you start us off on this?
Well, I think I already told you the first time I saw it was when the pilot aired before the series even started. And I had it recorded before any episodes were announced or coming or airing. So I had watched it several times before the series came out finally.
So you saw it when it came out.
Like out, like on TV, network. Yes, I was all about it from the get-go.
I do have a life that doesn't involve Babylon 5.
Season 1, I remember watching religiously. Like, I recorded every single episode, trying to get my friends to watch it, telling them how amazing it was. And some of them thought it was great. Some thought it was weird.
Love to, can't really. Next time.
But yeah, no, I just thought that the story was so well done. And that's really why you watch it. You know, I know a lot of people kind of hate on it because, you know, the effects are not that great. And like visually, it's not like super amazing. But the story is so compelling and so well crafted that it really just pulls you in and doesn't let go. So,
yeah. I'm with you on that. Ben, what do you recall from when you first saw Babylon 5?
Biggest thing that I recall is in nice parallel agreement with Tanya there. The story is what really stands out. First time I saw it was, as I said, about 10, 11 years ago. Was at pretty close to the lowest point in my life. Couldn't find any joy in anything, even things that I normally enjoyed. Was surfing a couch at a friend's house, and just every day was miserably trying to think of, well, is there any way that I can make my life better? But couldn't get out of the this all sucks. Observed that my buddy had the DVD series Babylon 5, and I had heard my friends talking about it for years and years and years, because I had missed it when it was originally aired. Every last one of them told me how wonderful it was. I've got all this time, and I've got these here, and I might as well distract myself. It successfully distracted me. Other shows that I usually enjoyed watching didn't anymore. This did. It had a story that pulled me in, kept my attention, and at least for a while, my brain was distracted from unhappiness. It was so because I was really interested in what was happening. Exactly what we mentioned earlier, there was no reset button. Stuff that happened mattered, and it stayed. It was a very engaging storyline for me. And the effects were decent enough, but really it was the stories and the characters.
It's quite the testament.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty damn inspiring. You know, to have something that's that strong pull you out of a moment that, you know, where things are dark. And I'll tell you, it's done that for me at different times because I've watched it now. And I think I was telling Tanya, I've seen the series maybe 25 times or more through. And when you consider it's a 5-year arc with over 110 episodes, that's a lot of watch. That's a lot of watching.
A lot of time invested.
Yeah. My first time seeing Babylon 5, I was hanging out with a mutual friend of Tanya and mine. His name is Jamie. And we were going to college together, and we would hang out fairly often doing different things. Sometimes we'd go to a bar and drink. Sometimes we'd hang out and play games or do whatever. And one day he decided that I'd come back with him to his place he was staying at first. Or maybe I don't remember exact details of why we were going there, but I know that Amy, another friend of ours, owned the apartment. So we go up to the door, and he opens the door, and we go in, and there are 20 people sprawled out on the floor and on couches in every available space. And I'm like, wait, what's going on? And he said, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, it's Babylon 5 Day. And I said, Babylon what? I had no idea. I hadn't seen the show. I want to say it was 1994 because it was the year after what Tanya said. It could have been 94 or 95. No, I'm going to say it's the second season. So it might have been even 95. I'm not sure. But it was a long time ago. Either way, I was so curious. I'm like, what is so compelling that all of these people gather? Because back then, you could record things to watch. Yeah. But there was still television times, right? Things aired at a specific time. And all of these people got together in their college years to watch this show. And I was really compelled. So I watched while I was there. I was horribly confused. And of course, they're all oohing and aahing as the reveals happen. And I'm thinking, okay, I've got to watch this. I've got to see what this is all about. I made sure when I went home to try to find it on television. And I started watching in season 2. And as I'm going, I'm kind of lost. I don't know what's going on. So I made sure to go out and try to find the VHS tapes, right? Because DVD was kind of a thing at this point, but it wasn't really a thing. I had a VHS player. Mm-hmm. And there was a place at the mall called Suncoast Pictures. I don't know if you guys remember that. But they sold videos, VHS cassette tapes, because that was the big thing. And I remember paying like some ridiculous price, like $69.95 or something, for the first 3 VHS copies in a box set. And I think it might have been 6 episodes. I don't know. My mom has the DVDs now. Or not the DVDs, but the VHS cassette tapes. Mm-hmm. And I subsequently probably broke myself buying this damn series because I got so into it. And once I had dove into Babylon 5, there was no coming back up for air. It was that engrossing, that compelling, and the rest is history. And Tanya knows how much I love this show. It's been part and parcel to some of the better moments in my life. And even this last year, as we came out of the COVID 2020 year, I've had some wonderful experiences that are surrounded by this show. And we've gotten some here, right here on this very podcast, and are likely to have some more, which I might talk about later. You know, I don't want to eat up all the time here because there's other things about the show Babylon 5 that we should talk about that won't spoil things for people. Let's talk about physics. I know this is your sexy talk, right, Ben? Physics?
I don't think I quite phrase it that way, but yeah. Okay,
this show was praised for the way it presented space. If you think about Star Wars, even Star Trek, a lot of the shows had ships flying around in space as if they were flying through atmosphere.
Yep.
Babylon 5 did not do that. They actually paid attention to the laws of physics. Things like creating gravity on ships was done by rotating sections of the ships. One of probably the most true, to me, spaceships from science fiction would be the Star Fury.
Yeah. I love that how it can just like stop and pew, turn around and like go wherever it needs to go. And because it is in a vacuum, so that would be the way it would actually behave.
Yeah.
And that was the first show I ever saw it be addressed.
Well, and it worked like a gyro, right? That's the right word. It's not, it's not gyro, right? No, it's a gyro.
No, it's not a sandwich.
But delicious.
Oh, yeah. It's just a delicious shit. So it has little thrusters on the end of each X point axis, and it would spin. Mm-hmm. And you could theoretically, you know, they show it actually in action, flying forward, spinning around and keeping momentum and being able to fire back at an opponent, which I thought was really freaking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good attention to the details of what should actually happen out in space.
Yep. The only thing they kind of cheated on was the sound, explosions and stuff, because in a vacuum, there's no sound, right?
Right.
The whole Alien tagline, in space, nobody can hear you scream. Yes. And the reason is because there's no sound. But, you know, you're presenting a television show. Joe's words, it has to be great television. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want that pew, pew, right? Pew, pew, pew. As we talk about the beginning of the show, Earth, the humans, are not the most advanced race.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
More likely than not matches reality, as opposed to humans always being like top of the food chain, going to primitive planets, seeing how they live because they're studying them anthropologically. Like it's actually like we all the reason we went into space in that show was because we encountered aliens that provided us with that technology. And that probably is close to assuming if something like that were to happen, that would be how it would happen, most likely.
Yeah. I'd love to see the Simpsons ape this and go, you know, have an alien come up to the humans and go, you're still using fossil fuels. Ha ha.
If we're still on the topic of Earth, I actually have a lot to say about that. Like, I find it interesting that, I mean, we can kind of talk about the government a little bit. Not much has really changed on Earth. Like, I don't think we're spoiling anything by talking about that. But, like, one world government. There's a president, there's a vice president, there's a senate. Nations still sort of have their own identities, as we have like the Russian consortium and things of that nature. So politically, things are kind of the same. There's still a class system, which is very relevant throughout a lot of the show. Major corporations abound, major conglomerates, which I won't get into because I don't want to spoil things for later. And then the Interstellar News Network. We have Disney Planet, people. Like, that's an aside. That's not a spoiler. It's just a cute thing they threw in. But of course, there's a Disney Planet in space. Right. So
it's almost dystopian.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, society will never be a Star Trek. Oh, we eliminated poverty ages ago. Like, right. that's not real.
Yeah, you had the down below area where people who had come to Babylon 5 for their hopes and dreams to be answered ended up not getting them fulfilled and being stuck there because they didn't have the money to get out. So they end up living down below where they don't have to pay rent. They just become these sort of urchins. It's interesting to see that dynamic, the social dynamic. JMS, when he wrote this, obviously wanted to not try to prettify everything like, you know, Star Trek did. And I don't get me wrong, I don't want to disparage Star Trek. I love Star Trek. I think,
yeah, same.
That, I mean, that's an ideal. It's an ideal future where we've gotten rid of currency. We've gotten rid of all these things, you know. People are doing what they're supposed to be doing as opposed to what they have to. In Babylon 5, It's very different. You are surviving. You're still trying to survive, even in the future. And it's even worse in many cases. So, yeah, I liked it a lot. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I really enjoy the fact that even though that, I guess, nation of Earth, Earthers are the ones who built the Babylon station and the ones who are in charge of the station itself. First, the audience is tempted to believe that, okay, well, we've put ourselves on top of the heap again in the storyline. But no, we are definitely not the most powerful kid on the block out there. Within the ongoing story, we do have to keep that in mind. Just because our main characters, one of them is called Commander all the time, doesn't mean he's in charge of everybody.
Yeah.
Because if anything, he is basically an equal footing ambassador to all the ambassadors on the station. It's just that his home planet happens to own the physical station itself. But that doesn't mean that he's in charge of everybody.
Yeah, he's always towing a line, if you think about it, because one of the major backdrop things that doesn't spoil anything to mention is that Earth had just gotten out of a war with another major alien race called the Minbari. And Earth had been in a war just previous to that with the Dilgar. And all of this stuff is revealed as the series goes on. It's not a major, you know, spoiler plot killing thing to talk about. But the Minbari obviously almost wiped out humanity, and they stopped for some reason, which is a big story point. And they chose, after the everybody decided to put aside their differences and build this station. They built four before it. 1, 2, and 3 explode. 4 disappears. 5 is Babylon 5, which is the, you know, namesake of the show. And the aliens essentially choose Sinclair to run this station. And here's this guy who survived this war. He's got severe PTSD, you know, and he's towing this line. He's a capable commander, but he almost seems lost a lot of time, and this is why. And it makes sense. It's a very realistic portrayal of somebody who's sort of in over their head.
Yeah.
But because they're capable, they're able to sort of navigate. He has to be a diplomat, a leader. He has to do all of these things. And the guy who played him was a theater actor before he came to television. He didn't have a whole lot of television credits. And I thought he did a phenomenal job bringing this across and bringing across the nuance of that character.
Yeah, agreed. I think he did a very good job. And I also think, too, important to mention that even though he was the commander of the station, he was still not really the one in charge because he was still beholden to the politics of Earth and what they wanted and what they were kind of ordering or like pressuring him to do. So, and I think that came across as well.
Right. Well, you know, again, with the technology, the station itself spins and creates gravity, although they don't have full gravity everywhere. Right.
Right.
I guess gravity in CNC is something like 40%. And at one point we see the effects of, you know, something floating out across the station while the ground is spinning around beneath it. No spoilers, not saying what that is, but the station's parked in orbit around Epsilon. Is it 3 or 4?
Epsilon 3.
And I think in the pilot was where they show the station going out of, you know, out of the orbit a little bit and having to use its thrusters to get back into orbit. But all of this stuff shows that humans have a fairly good idea of technology, but it's not great. And then you juxtapose that with like the Minbari. And the Minbari have artificial gravity on their ships. They make a comment about it at some point. It's like, you don't even have artificial gravity, right? And then you have the Vorlons, the mysterious Vorlons, right? And they, one of my favorite things about this first season, you know, I get all excited when I think about Kosh. I mean, Kosh, he's just great.
Yes.
They have organic technology, and, you know, the ship does really cool things. And they're this powerful race that shows up to council meetings when they want to, right?
Yeah.
And is super cryptic. It's just, it's phenomenal story building. And there's a lot of world building that goes on in season one.
Good.
And people, there are people who online say, yeah, skip season one. it's not worth watching. It's just a bunch of world building, a lot of exposition.
They're wrong. They're wrong.
Well, JMS would agree with you. Very recently on Twitter, somebody had posted about, you know, skipping season one, and JMS's words were, people who want to skip season one do not understand the value of foreplay.
Yeah. Well, and that's so perfect, because even things that seem insignificant, even episodes that seem totally one-off and not really linked to anything, they'll come back to it like 2 years later. And you're like, oh my God, that what just happened?
Yeah.
But yeah, like you have to start with the first season. Must.
Yeah, even in some of the more maligned episodes of the first season, which I think would be like Infection, TKO, according to most fans, those are probably two of the worst episodes of the season. Important things happen in those episodes that contribute to the overall greater storyline. And a lot of times, you know, I'll be rewatching and go, oh yeah, here comes this episode. And I remember the last time I watched TKO, it really wasn't that bad. But you know, the other things that happen in the episode are worth watching it for.
There is a hole in your mind.
I mean, technically, that's the pilot.
That's the pilot. It's still a great quote.
It is a great quote.
Not necessarily a quote, but it's a quote that didn't happen that stood out for me. One character is talking to another character about the nature of a sneak attack and saying that, you know, we humans know a lot about sneak attacks, and proceeds to list Pearl Harbor and then the nuclear annihilation of San Diego and lists a few other, you know, made up ones that are supposed to be walking their way forward through history. And in this recent rewatch of mine, my brain's instant reaction was, why the hell didn't he list 9/11?
And the time. Just,
and just as immediately reminded myself, okay, this was written before that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I had to take that moment and ask myself why, because the writing, the interactions of the characters doesn't feel like something that was done 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, that could have gone better.
Yeah.
It feels like writing and interacting that you would find today.
It's very contemporary.
Yeah.
Which means if it's contemporary now, it means he was ahead of his time then.
Yeah, quite so.
Yeah. There's a lot of story elements that just resonate to today and to recent things that have happened in our society. And I'm not going to tell you what those things are. I'm not going to spell those things out. If you're watching it, you're going to see it. You know, you're going to see exactly what those things are. Let's talk about the different races that are on there. We've got the Minbari, the very sort of, they've got a three caste system. They've got religious, worker, and warrior. And they come across as very level-headed and very serene when they're presented. Of course, they have their moments, obviously. We've got, what else do we have? The Narn. And the Narn are
presented as kind of the negative image of that.
Right. They're very hot-tempered. They've been occupied for years by the Centauri, which is another alien race. And they're basically hell-bent on this vengeful path. And the Centauri and the Narn create kind of the I think one of the major backdrops, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
their conflict is pretty much ongoing, whereas everybody else has sort of hit that point where they're tired of war, they're tired of conflict, and they're just trying to find a way to peacefully get to the next stage. Yet the Narn and the Centauri are constantly aggravating each other, which is, I think it's great because it gives a lot of tension. Earth had been in the war with the Minbari, so you've got the tension there. They don't fully trust each other, right?
The Centauri and the Narn, they do an excellent job of illustrating the difference between a war that has a beginning and an end versus a vendetta.
Yeah.
Because the Centauri and the Narn definitely have a mutually declared vendetta that the two races just are not giving up on.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, it sort of all consumes really every thought for both the Narn and the Centauri, for just revenge and why didn't we destroy you the first time? But each person can say the exact same thing about each other because there's so much animosity because of the past.
They tackle a lot of things in this season without going into detail that I think separate this show from other science fiction series. Things like parents' rights versus state rights, right? You have an episode where that's kind of an issue. Yeah. And it pits religion and science almost against each other. And it's very compelling. I don't want to give any spoilers away or anything like that, but having grown up in a religious household where they did have points of view like this, they felt like, I can just say somebody in my family had a heart attack and he died waiting for a bloodless surgery because he could not have a blood transfusion. And one of the episodes in this series sort of tackles this, and a lot of fans kind of hate on the episode of this episode of the show. To me, it's like, well, you're missing the fact that this is a direct metaphor. This is, allegory for something that happens in the real world. And if you hate it, I kind of have to wonder, is it because it's touching a raw nerve or because you're so defensive over your beliefs that this show, this episode has hit you the wrong way?
It is one of the most bummer episodes of the series. Like it's a downer to watch. It is. So I don't even know that it's necessarily, it's hitting a nerve. Like it just sucks to watch. So
yeah. See, and I absolutely love it, but again, it doesn't have to be the, storybook ending for something to be watchable and likable. But, I don't want to give too much away on it. Let's talk about they tackle massive deadly contagions. Gee, what happened recently in our history? COVID. Nothing, hello.
Nothing at all like that.
They have that happen in season one. They talk about races that had formerly committed genocide. And it actually comes back to bite them. Workers' rights. There's an episode dealing with workers' rights and having to deal with strikes and things of that nature. These are all very grown up, very like now sort of issues that still happen in the world today, which is pretty cool. You have government agents trying to create turmoil, and I'm not going to say which government, I'm not going to say which people, but they're trying to silence. And that's a thing that has happened throughout history, right? You have choosing between following orders and doing what's right. It's kind of a big theme, fighting for something greater, being willing to even die unnoticed if you're fighting for the right thing. And one theme that comes back over and over in Babylon 5 is that choices matter. Every choice you make along the way will either do something wonderful or do something horrible. You don't always know at the time you make the decision. Sometimes you're just trying to save face. Sometimes you're trying to do something great. Sometimes you think you're doing the right thing and it totally turns out to blow up in your face and be the wrong thing. I think that it's one of the things I enjoy the most about the show.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Because there's such a tapestry of decisions that are made that are so consequential in ways that the person making them would never have anticipated. Just the ripples that one thing causes are so palpable. So that I think was the beautiful thing about the series.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's one thing that made the series feel more real for a lot of the audience, is that the way in which actions had consequences wasn't simply, okay, here's this minor consequence within this one episode, but it'll all be washed away by next week.
Right.
But no, not only were the consequences there, but then there were, as Tanya said, ripples. There were additional things that would happen as a result that you probably didn't expect from your experience watching any other series.
Yeah, definitely. That we're talking about all the things and the themes and all this stuff because Babylon 5 is built on so many wonderful concepts. The story is so vast and reaching, and the plot complications, the character dynamics. One of the problems we had before starting this show was deciding how many episodes do we devote to Babylon 5? Because honestly, but I know Tanya and I could at least speak for probably 20 hours on the subject. And I know you also have quite a few opinions on Babylon 5 as well, Ben. Maybe not as, yeah, I mean, you're not as lost underneath the undertow as we are, but it's one of those things that there is so many concepts, there's so many episodes, there's so many things that they tackle in this. It's just astounding to think that all of this came out of the mind of one man. And it really is, you know, the province of J. Michael Straczynski. And, you know, now he's got this reboot on the way. And I kind of want to address it because it is the elephant in the room. There are a lot of people who are not happy that there's a reboot. Oh, it's on the CW. What are they going to recast a bunch of teens to play these parts? Yada, yada, yada. I'm going to say right off the bat that Straczynski has answered a lot of these things on his Twitter account. But if there's any writer in this world that I trust to rewrite his own show and change it to create a new story for a new time, it's J. Michael Straczynski.
Yeah.
A lot of the fans are like, well, why doesn't he just do a continuation? Well, here's a couple of reasons. Most of the cast is dead, at least half of the cast, which is astounding. Mm-hmm. It's sad. It's depressing. He had somebody gatekeeping at Warner Brothers, preventing the show from ever coming back out again. And that's a big obstacle. So for 20 plus years, he hasn't been able to touch this product because it's not his. They own it. And with somebody in the way, he was never going to get the opportunity to continue telling the story. Since so much time has passed, so many of the actors have died, it only makes sense to bring this show back and reboot it so you can get new audience on board. Because if you're doing a continuation, you're asking everybody to go back and watch 5 years of the show that hasn't been on since the 90s and then watch the continuation. It's ridiculous. So rebooting it is the best and the most, I think, sane way to go about getting this series back on the air and continuing on with it as a franchise. How do you guys feel about that?
I think it makes complete sense. You know, it may not be easy to ask an audience to go back and watch the original series again. I haven't tried looking for copies of the DVDs today. I don't know how easy or difficult they would be to find. I know it's currently available on one of the streaming services, but goodness only knows how much longer it will be. And then after that, where do you go to find it? So yeah, it would be a considerable hill to climb to ask a brand new audience to, hey, before you watch my continuation series, in order to understand what's going on in that series, you need to go find copies of this show that you might not be able to find. So yeah, the reboot makes sense.
Yeah. To answer that point right there, it's on Amazon Prime, the original release. On HBO Max, it is a remastered version of Babylon 5. And you've got to use an episode guide to watch it because a lot of them are out of order. But what they did with the remaster was it was initially shot. I think the aspect ratio was shot for television, but the CGI was shot for widescreen. So a lot of the transfers onto VHS, DVD, and whatnot have these weird scenes where everything's stretched or doesn't look correct. And HBO Max fixed that. And I think that when HBO Max put Babylon 5 out with a remaster, I got really excited because I was like, wait, I thought nobody was touching this property. And it was sort of the first step in everything, kind of the first domino falling, I think. So anyway, Tanya, go ahead and give us your opinion on this because I just wanted to answer that.
Yeah, I am excited to see what happens. I'm excited to see new life brought into this story. I can't wait to see what it feels like with stellar visual effects, like melding the Babylon 5 storyline with like the Battlestar Galactica quality battle scenes is like orgasmic to me, like so exciting. I cannot wait for that to happen. I will say though that I am also feeling a bit of anxiety almost because I am so attached to this show.
Right.
And I don't want to be like, well, then why did they do it that way? That's stupid, you know? So I definitely, because I mean, I have strong opinions. And so I just need to know, okay, go in with an open mind. It's still going to be amazing.
I am
excited. Overall.
I think you're in the same boat as a lot of fans that have been experiencing this sort of, you know, weird apprehension about the reboot. And I get it. I totally get it. Babylon 5 to me is near and dear to my heart. It's one of my favorite shows that I've ever seen, and it's going to be redone. And one of the big things that people worry about is, you know, the integrity of the show. It's like, well, no, the show is still there. You have 5 years that will never be changed. The reboot is a wholly different product, and there's only one character going forward so far that remains the same that anybody knows of, and it's in name only. At this point, the only character that we know of is John Sheridan. So many of those characters from the original series may not even be in this incarnation. Who, he's already said that he's almost finished the pilot. I know this because I watch every tweet that comes out of this man's hands, right? So the trepidation, I understand that, because I don't want Babylon 5 to change either, but I also acknowledge that change is inevitable. And the show needs to adapt to this time and this age. You said it yourself. Seeing a Babylon 5 type story with the special effects of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, think about how kind of... I mean, I loved Battlestar Galactica growing up, but it's kind of goofy, right? You had robots and kids, right? But it was still a cool show, and the Cylons terrified me. I remember going to Universal Studios, and they had that ride. And it felt like the lasers were shooting past us. I don't know how they did it. Movie magic of some sort. But I was terrified as a kid. Those Cylons scared the crap out of me. And those were the goofy toaster Cylons, right? The new ones. And I thought Battlestar Galactica, not to get off too far on this, started off great. And then it sort of, something happened around season 3 and I just lost interest. But I don't think I'll lose interest with Straczynski telling the story. He's done so many wonderful and great things since he did Babylon 5. He's matured as a writer. And I'm excited. I'm really excited to see what they do.
Yep.
Yes.
I'm totally looking forward to it.
I know I talk a lot. Sorry, guys.
No, it's all right.
So we can talk about each character in the show. I don't really want to go too heavily into that. In fact, one of the things I do want to talk about is I had mentioned earlier, the number of cast members who we've lost. And celebrity deaths, you know, some affect me, some don't. You know, I think it depends to me on what they've done, because, you know, a lot of these people I don't know personally, but I have a connection to a performance that they've given. So when they go, I feel like, oh, you know, feel that hit from the performance. Like, you know, they'll never do this again or whatever. I'm not sure. You know, also maybe it's connected to a point in time of my life that I'm very happy about, or something that brought me joy or kept us out of a dark spot. So losing these actors has always hurt, in my opinion, especially from Babylon 5. And I'm going to list off a couple of the ones. Actually, I've got 9 that I'm going to list off here that died. Some died really shortly after the show was off air, and then some have died as recently as last year or this year. So Richard Biggs, who played Dr. Franklin, died very young. Yeah. Was it an aneurysm or pulmonary something? He basically stood up from bed, said something, fell over and died. And that was in May of 2004. And this was a very fit man. I just recently met Bruce Boxleitner, who played Captain Sheridan from seasons 2 through 5. It was in some of the movies and whatnot. I met him at the Silicon with Adam Savage. It's this convention. It was really cool. And the man talked to me for an hour. I was there with my mother because, you know, I've only gone to a couple conventions in my life, and both times I brought my mom. Bruce Boxleitner was a wonderful man. And he gave us so much time. He was really gracious. And he started talking about the cast members who had left us. And, you know, at one point, and he wasn't, I wouldn't say nearly in tears, but man, he was, you could see how affected he was. And he went through these people. And the second one to die was Andreas Katsalas, who played Jakar. And I think this one hit me in the beginning so hard, right? Because you love him throughout this series. He's just so good. The man could read a phone book and you'd listen, you know, with attention.
Yeah.
But he died in February of 2006. He was a lifetime smoker. And they all talk about it in the interviews and whatnot. You know, between takes, he'd be out there puffing on a ciggy. And sadly, he died of lung cancer. Then we had Johnny Seca, who was in the pilot, played Dr. Benjamin Kyle. He died in 2006 as well. The next person to die was Jeff Conaway. Actually, Tim Choate died in here somewhere. I don't have his date on here. I should have it. But he played Zathras, another great character that everybody loved.
Zathras is used to being beast of burden to other people's needs.
Zathras is used to being beast of burden to other people's needs. Very sad life. Probably have very sad death, but at least there is symmetry.
Oh, Zathras, yeah. He died in a motorcycle accident, so very sad.
Oh, that's
young
awful.
Man's life cut short. Jeff Conaway, who was in Grease, Taxi, did all these wonderful things. He passed away in May of 2011. He had a long history of substance abuse.
You ever have one of those days?
Michael O'Hare, who played Sinclair, passed away in September of 2012. And his is a really interesting story. I'm not going to go into detail on this here, but he was going through a lot. And I mean a lot when he was on the set, dealing with, you know, a lot of stress and some breakdowns that happened between him and the crew, him and the other actors. And at one point, Straczynski almost tanked the show to save his mental health, which, who does that? I mean, this is a director willing to tank his baby to save the mental health of this one man. And to O'Hare's credit, he didn't want to do that because he didn't want to put these other actors out of work. It's an amazing story. And Straczynski talks about it. You can look it up online. And I recommend you do so. I don't want to talk about that here because, you know, it is a very sad tale and his ending wasn't quite that happy, but he was a man who had a great character and great strength of character. And it really showed up in this point in his life. So he died in September, 2012. The next was Robin Sachs, who died in February of 2013. Then of course, Jerry Doyle, who played Michael Garibaldi, had a long history of alcohol abuse in his life, went through a lot of things. He passed away in July of 2016. Then Stephen First, who was in Animal House, he played Veer Koto, a character everybody loves. And yes, man, he has some wonderful stories. He passed away in 2017. And most recently, and probably the most heartbreaking, was Mira Furlan. Furlan. I'm not sure which way it's pronounced, but she died in January of this year from, of all things, being bit by a mosquito. She got West Nile virus in this day and age. Wow. In LA. And,
oh my gosh.
And it killed her. And
yeah. Well, what's fun? I mean, West Nile is around. It is. I mean, people die of it in Southern California every year. But the irony of it being during a COVID pandemic,
yeah,
is just really so awful.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, when Bruce was talking about this, he said that when he learned of it, he was in a hotel in Canada. He just got there. He was going to be filming something, and he was put into quarantine for 14 days. He learned about this on day one of a 14-day quarantine. And he was climbing the walls.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and man, I sympathize so much. I feel so, so heavily for him. It was, you know, he was very real. And it was touching to me that he was willing to share this. There's so much more about my interaction with him that I'll probably share in the next episode. because it was just an honor to meet the guy. But anyway, I wanted to acknowledge those cast passings, even though there's a whole lot more. A lot of the guest actors have left and gone beyond the rim as well. And you look at the number of you look at the attrition, and other shows that have been around, you know, 20, 30 years longer don't have this level of attrition. It's really sad. And then you look at the reboot and go, really, you wanted to continue the story on without the actors who played those parts? I think a reboot's the only way you can do it. Yeah. Now, and he's going to involve the surviving actors. They've all been told that they're going to be part of it. So there's that to look forward to as well.
Yeah, that's excellent.
There's the shining beacon in space right there to this whole depressing point of all these actors passing away, you know, and I'm sure that he's going to find ways to honor them somehow. And for those listening that want to suggest to Straczynski plot points and actors to play parts and this, that, and the other, he's asked us not to do that. He doesn't want you messaging him with story ideas, because as soon as you do that, he can't use it. So please don't message Straczynski with story ideas, right?
That's a good point.
You're actually going to just inhibit his process of coming up with storylines and not help. So anyway, let's move along. One thing I want to add to this discussion is other podcasts that people can listen to that go into in-depth episodic analysis of Babylon 5. Because obviously we're a podcast that goes into movies, series, whatever we feel like doing, this pop culture, and we change subjects pretty much every episode, almost every episode. But if you really want to get into a podcast that does an in-depth every episode analysis, I'd look at these following podcasts. The first one's called A Conspiracy of Light, and you can find it on Spotify. I like it. It's these two guys who work in the mental health field, and their analysis a lot of the time recenters on that. And they talk about implications of things like PTSD and depression and whatnot as it applies to the show. So it's a fairly quiet affair. They don't have a lot of bangs and whistles on their podcast, but I really enjoy it. I really enjoy their conversations. The second one I just found very recently and was interacting with one of the podcasters on Facebook. So I went and listened to it because, you know, he gave me a link and I thought, hey, I've got to check this out. And I know it's a weird name, but they actually do a very good in-depth analysis. They're both Australian, and the show is called Yum Yum 5. Don't ask. You know, their previous podcast was about Star Trek. Somebody said something about Yum Yum and they talk about it. I don't get it, but their discussion about Babylon 5 is really good. And some of the things that they mentioned, they actually brought up in this show to give them some credit. So give them a look. They're on Spotify as well. The last one is another person I interact with on Facebook through a Babylon 5 site. And his show has definitely got bells and whistles. And he's got a lot of supporters, people who support him through Patreon. And he also adapted a previous show he did called the White Rocket Podcast and turned it into the White Rocket Babylon 5 Review Podcast. So you can find them on Podbean. So why am I plugging other podcasts that haven't plugged us? Well, simply because you're going to get more analysis from these guys on this show. We would love to do that, but this isn't a Babylon 5 podcast. It's just a Babylon 5 episode. Sorry to disappoint you. Anyway, we've got Julie Caitlin Brown here, and she's got a lot of stuff to say. What do you guys think about that? Do you guys remember Natoth?
Love Natoth. Love Julie Caitlin Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Both amazing.
As we're going into the interview section of this podcast, which I did mention in the very beginning, there will be spoilers. So you might want to pause this podcast. Go watch Babylon 5. Yes, all 5 seasons. Because we're going to talk to Julie Caitlin Brown, and she's going to reveal things that happened throughout the 5 seasons to her, other characters, and then we're going to talk more about spoilers, right?
You will not regret it. Go watch Babylon 5.
Yes. And then come back
to
us.
You're welcome.
come back to us. And then next week, of course, not next week, next 2 weeks, we're going to do the in-depth analysis and talk about everything that we didn't talk about here. And it's going to be fun. And we're going to try. We're going to try to squeeze it into our little, you know, time spot. But we'll do our best. And it's very possible I'm in talks with another person from Babylon 5. It's very possible. I'm not going to guarantee it, but we might have another interview. So I'll leave you all with that. So, any last thoughts here before we segue into the interview section?
I think we should just jump right into the interview.
Yeah, I agree with Tanya. Go watch Babylon 5. It is absolutely worth it. You will thank us for it. And then you'll be primed to see what new things J. Michael Straczynski is going to come up with in the reboot.
The avalanche has already started. It is too late for the pebbles to vote.
And now for the pop celebrity interview.
Today, joining us on Zoom is the actress who played the attaché to the Narn ambassador, Jakar. You will remember her as Natoth. Popped would like to welcome Julie Caitlin Brown. Hello, Julie.
Hi.
Welcome, Julie.
Hi, Tanya and Daniel. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. It's been a long time
thank
coming.
Thank you for being here.
Well, it's an auspicious time, isn't it? I know we're going to talk about what's on everybody's mind in a hot second, but wow, we couldn't have timed this more perfectly.
Right? From one side of the pandemic to the other. And are we really on the other side?
I don't know.
No.
Yeah. It's here to stay for a little while, but hopefully we'll all start to, you know, get it and get over it and get back to some semblance of normalcy soon.
Yeah. They've been canceling some conventions, letting others go on. And conventions are kind of a big thing for you because you run a company that books actors for these conventions. And it's how we met.
I know. It's so wild. It's
been met.
That's how we came to know each other. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that was the lovely days of MySpace. If anybody remembers that.
Wow. We're going way back in time travel now.
I don't even have access to that stuff anymore. And I was thinking, it would be lovely to go back and find those things and surprise you with them, but I can't. You were in that time, you had a handful of actors and you were starting to book them at conventions and you were looking for the contacts. And me being the dork that I was at that time, was on all of those pages. And I interacted with all those people. So you messaged me and out of the blue, and I'm sitting there at my computer one day and I'm like, Julie Caitlin, I know that name. I about lost it. But
I'm glad that we connected because you really helped me, you know, find the people I needed to find. Back then when we were doing conventions, I would literally pitch by getting headshots and resumes and bios and putting them in a manila envelope and mailing them to the promoter.
That's the old school musician way.
That is the old school way to do it. Yeah.
Wow.
I had been an agent for rock bands and high level comics when I was 22 years old. So when I had my first son, so that I learned the business righteously and then married it to the Screen Actors Guild contract and just said, there's a lot of potential here. You guys need to grow up. And
that's serendipity, really.
Become a business.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was a dork at that time, loved Babylon 5. You know, I was in college, and at college I met this person here, which is Tanya. And she and I geeked out on Babylon 5 quite a bit. We actually power watched it.
Yes.
I think I came over to your house and we power watched it the entire 5 seasons.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And I think we ate and slept and that was it.
Yeah. And I had recorded everything on videotape. I still have all VHS. Of the old VHS tapes. And I remember I moved to Arizona and they were all kind of scattered on different tapes. And so I spent weeks re-recording them all in order so that I could take them with me.
Wow.
Yeah. Commitment.
Commitable. I mean, commitment. Yes. Fabulous. Done. My mom has the original set because, of course, one of the things that you get when you're on a show like that and you're as series regular, you get access to the original VHS. They want you to have it. Mm-hmm. And so my mother has possession of all of my Babylon 5 episodes. And when you watch Joe's work, JMS, Joe Straczynski, when you watch how well he plotted all of his story points and then paid them off, I mean, he really gave me a lot of inspiration. When I started writing, I developed a couple of series and pitched it around Hollywood. I've got a Broadway musical that I've written now. I'm doing a rewrite based on the musical Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And I always remember what he taught me in terms of how you develop a character and how deep you go into the psyche of a character. Never skim the top. You always have to know why someone's doing what they're doing. And potentially, as you know, the God who is creating their next step, you have to really think about, you know, we all have different avenues we could follow. If you had an aerial view of your life, there are myriad paths that one could take. What makes you take one rather than the other?
Yes, brilliant.
And that's what he did. He was able to, you know, we were all got enmeshed in what was happening, and then all of a sudden he'd curveball you and you'd be like, oh. And you go, oh, but that ties back to season one.
Right. And it was all about choices.
Yes. Yes.
Which life is all about choices too. I mean.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can look back and go, you know, that series was ahead of its time. I was also had the fortune to be on Deep Space Nine, which is a sore spot for Joe because it kind of feels like they were similar concepts.
Right.
But
a little bit.
But working in Star Trek world and working in Babylon 5 world, at that point, Star Trek was done by committee. In right. other words, there were multiple writers. There wasn't one Gene Roddenberry's singular vision. I did work on The Next Generation as well. So you could see that there was a Bible that they were following, but it had spun out into all these different series. They were not, it wasn't a narrative. It was episodic. Joe's work was a narrative.
Yeah.
Joe's work had an arc overreaching everything, and he knew where everyone was going to end up. And there's a vast difference with that type of writing than when you're doing episodic, where we all know and love these characters, and here's this episode's challenge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I agree.
Question for you regarding the whole arc. Did you or the cast sort of have knowledge beforehand of where your characters were headed? Or were you as surprised as the audience once you received the scripts?
I was one of the few people that was given an opportunity to look at the Bible. And that was because when I took the part, it's been on many other Ooh. Podcasts, I will do the Reader's Digest version of this. There were two. There was Kodath. She couldn't take the lenses. She left. Then there was Mary Kay was after me. Then there was another actress who got the pilot, and then she went to do the actual episode. Okay, so Kodath was in the pilot, and then the next girl came on and she ripped the makeup off her face in the middle of makeup for the episode. And I got a call from Mary Jo Slater saying, I have a job for you. And I went, what? So I went up there and I looked at Joe, and I just come off of Broadway as a lead in a musical, a Tony Award-winning musical. And I didn't look bad. I was kind of a good-looking younger woman, maybe 30.
You were a gorgeous woman at any age. Yeah.
60. Oh, yeah.
Dang. So, life goals.
Yeah, 60. Woo. But the makeup gave me facial peels the whole time. So because she ripped the makeup off her face, it was one of those things where there was a lot of trauma in the makeup room. And so I went into Joe's office and I went, hey, you know, I read for Ivanova. I read for Delenn. I said, I've worked in Star Trek. I'm not afraid of the makeup, but tell me why I want this part. What is this part doing? What is this character doing? And he told me this. Now, I don't know if I should say this or not, but he basically said, eventually, Jakar goes rogue and you become the ambassador.
Oh, wow.
That's it. And he also talked to me about it being a matriarchal society, and that my grandmother had been very powerful in that society, and that my agenda was to get up into the ranks and get as high as I could and then return it to a matriarchal society. So those kinds of things, he gave me broad strokes, right? Made me want to do it. And it was just that we couldn't come to terms on the makeup, and it was hurting my face. My eyes, little scar, I mean, like little cuts, and, you know, I was exhausted. And, you know, those are get up at 3 a.m. and make up at 4 a.m. and work from 7 to 7:30 and half an hour off and then drive an hour home. And, you know, I had a kid and it was hard. But yeah, they let me know some things.
That was actually, we had a listener that had a question about that. Mm-hmm. Let me see if it really quick. It was, I don't know if it's Jean or Jean in New Orleans. You can never know if it's in New Orleans, right? Asked if it was allergy to the prosthetics that made you leave the show or some other reason.
It wasn't, I wasn't allergic to it. The characters were the best I'd ever played. My makeup artists were fantastic. The problem was when you're attaching to anchor points over and over and over again with surgical glue and then taking it off with detach-all, which is what they use to take apart when they put electrodes on you, it's got silicone in it to break up it's really not good for your face. And I was starting to get auditions for other parts and movies and
my face. You're showing up with dots all over your face. Hurt,
you know, little marks and, you know, and Michael Dorn actually he taught me when we were on Star Trek, The Next Generation, he goes, never let them anchor to the same spot. Because he ended up with a scar.
Oh my.
Never let them anchor to the same spot. Move it around, play with it, take a break, ask them not to work you, you know, 6 days on an 8 day shoot.
Speaking of this character in Babylon 5 that you say it was the best character you've ever played, I've got a question for you and bear with me. It's fairly long.
Okay.
This question. I actually had to write it out because it's a quote of yours. And it leads to my question. So at a 2014 convention, you and the Babylon 5 group, you were all together again, reunited, and you were on stage together. And you were all asked what Babylon 5 gave to you, what you felt it did for you. And you had said that you felt Babylon 5 taught you, coming from the theater and auditioning for the role of Ivana Vendelin, to never give up, walk in every room and offer your gift as an artist, whatever that is, and leave it on the floor. You leave and you might get a phone call one day saying, they need you for a lizard. You may not get to play the beautiful Ivana or the amazing, gorgeous Delenn, but you get to work opposite Andreas Katsalas, wear red lenses, and kick ass, which I think is a brilliant quote. so when you look at that role now and everything that has come and gone with it, and it continues to give to you, where do you sit with it today?
Well, I wish that I had the patience I have now at 60 to have gone back and done a few more episodes and worked with Warner Brothers and proven to them that they need to pay the people in prosthetics as much as they're paying the people that you can see their face. I wish I would have had that clarity to advocate for myself better. I think I got scared. And I remember Joe brought me back as Guinevere Corey because he really still wanted to work with me and I wanted to work with him. Mm-hmm. And I was honored that at the end of the whole series, that he said, if I don't bring Julie Caitlin Brown to play Natoth when we find her in the dungeon, I don't want that to be Natoth. I want it to be another Narn. And I was absolutely touched by that. He saw two things in me that I have had to learn about as an artist. He saw a strength and he saw a fragility that when you're pushing through prosthetic makeup, it's hard to do. It's hard to reflect anything but strength when you're playing this warrior, right?
Yeah.
But when he gave me the scenes he gave me in that last episode, he allowed me to show that even though she was broken and she was so sure she was going to die in that prison, that she still had this strength. As weak as she was still threatening to kill, you know, Londo, you know, and it was like, yes, never give up, never quit, always do your best work. And what other people think of it's really none of your business. If it was your part, it was yours before you walked through the door, because you're rendezvousing with a previous intention. And the subjective fantasy of a writer, you know, I did a movie called All About Evil, and I remember walking into the casting and they went, yes, like that. And I was playing Tammy Denise, and I was extremely, you know, and I was it's really, I die with a pin to the neck. It's the first horror movie with Natasha Lyonne and Thomas Dekker. And the work that I did on Babylon 5 made me freer to be more outlandish. Mm. You know, playing aliens frees you up, because how the hell do you know what an alien does?
True.
So you have a playground in your mind, and it just frees you up from your face. You're not worried about what you look like. You're not worried about being pretty or how your figure looks. You're playing a true character, and I've always enjoyed that. So that's what it keeps giving to me, is that fearlessness.
Wonderful. It was such a beautiful episode too. I had wondered what happened to Natoth, because I'm going to tell you something. That was one of my favorite characters from the first season. And I was like, I was a little upset when she sort of disappeared from the narrative. And that was a question. Whatever happened to this character? And it got answered in season 5, you know?
Yeah. When the rock cried out, no hiding place, she goes back to Narn and everyone thinks she's dead. And that happened because Mary Kay Adams, who's a brilliant actress, she had a different take on the character. Mm-hmm. And I was there as Jakar's foil. I was there to mess with him, to push him, because there was an agenda in my mind that, you know, you're a buffoon and I'm going to bring the women back into power. So I'll get your coffee and I'll watch you, you know, screw all these women and do all this stuff. But you know, the moment where we actually became somewhat allied was Chrysalis. That scene across the desk where we're talking about, and we talked about it before. We talked about it and we said, okay, they are now going to join together, not because they really want to, but because circumstances force them to. Hmm.
It's interesting hearing that now, because one of the questions, believe it or not, my mom had asked me, had to do with that relationship between the two. And she was like, I always felt like she was really too close to him sometimes. And I didn't know how to really address that. And it was one of her questions for today. And I was like, I don't know if that's going to work, you know, as a question, but apparently it does.
well, here's the thing. In the beginning, she, you know, that's why that whole thing about who's the assassin.
Right.
Okay. There are three clues. One is Joe set it up that you think it could be Natoth. Mm-hmm. Okay. But Natoth ends up saving him. Then you have Deathwalker, where you see what a warrior Natoth is. She's a freaking badass. My son even said, he was 12, he goes, Mom, you fight like a gangster. That wasn't a stunt double.
He's like, I'll do the dishes.
Yeah. And then you see Chrysalis, and then you see that last episode. Basically, she came forward like a lot of women have to. And she did what she had to do to get in bed with the men who were in power. So she was subservient, which is, I think, why Mary Kay, and I won't speak for her, I would never do that for another actor, but my take was she played the subservience to demonstrate, you know, that she was compliant, but in underneath all of that, she was not. And Joe was very good about walking that line of, is Natoth with him or against him?
Nice.
And he always wanted you to wonder. And so there were some moments where it looked like I was really his, you know, buddy and support and cohort. And then there were other moments where it was like, you're an idiot. That's why sometimes it looks like, and it would have been more revealed over subsequent episodes, you know, her agenda. But. Right. I just, you know, Warner Brothers, God love you. I hope that we get to work together again. I think they now, because that was the nascent time of prosthetic makeup for Warner Brothers. Paramount was used to it. And their makeup artists were like, absolutely, you protected the actor's face. Mm-hmm. Hot towels and facials and all this stuff. So when I came over from the Paramount world to Warner Brothers, I was like, whoa, slow down on the glue. What's happening here? And I made them go slower, but you know, chop, chop, time is money. And I said, no. You're putting glue right up to my eyes and over the bones of my eyes. Slow down. And to their credit, Optic Nerve really did. They were like, you know what? You're right. This is the full face prosthetic with a head cowl and lenses. Yes, ma'am. We're going to slow down. And they were great. But I think his first name was Eric, was my makeup artist.
All right. Sounds good. I'm actually going to go with a fan question because we had some other questions, but you answered them already sort of inadvertently, which is great. So I'm going to ask a question from one of our fans or one of your fans, Lloyd Dobler from Seattle, Washington, who's clearly a synonym, but pseudonym. Sorry. He wanted to know, what is your favorite memory from working with Andreas Katsoulis?
Well, the funny thing about Andreas and I is that he'd already lost two attachés, right? One couldn't take the lenses. The other one ripped the makeup off her face in the room. And he was like, yeah, right. Are you sticking around? You know? And so we started talking about the theater. And when I told him I had just come from Broadway, and he is a theater person, he said, oh, good. Then you know how to work from the inside out. And I said, yes, I do. And then I said, but this is mask work. And he looked at me and he goes, yes, it is. And I said, so the over accentuation of our eyebrows and being able to let people see us think by moving our eyes or utilizing our head tilting or our hands. The minute I got into that stuff, he went, oh, okay. She knows what she's doing. Because a lot of people feel very encumbered by the makeup, I felt freed. And so we would just get in the makeup chair and we just run our lines and we talk about blocking, we play it, and we would get to the set and they go, rehearsal up, and we go, shoot it, it's not gonna get any better. Martini, we're done. You know, they like to save us when we were working together for the last shot of the day because they knew we've been sitting there for 3.5 hours, man. We were gonna get boom, boom. But I just love the humor of him. And there was a very funny moment where, I don't know if people will remember this probably, where he's got three women in bed with him and, you know, Sinclair comes to have a word and I went, the ambassador is very busy. He's a very heavy schedule, and out walked these three women. I went, and he'll see you now. You know, I mean, and Michael O'Hare almost jumped the line. Because I wanted to wait until the women kind of paraded by, and I went, and he will see you now, you know? And right. I went, because Michael's from the stage. We right. were actually on Broadway at the same time. And I said, he was doing A Few Good Men. And I said, give me a beat. Could you just give me the take? I know you can't see what I'm doing because I'm covered in prosthetics, but just give me, and he went, okay. And Andreas we just had that rhythm. We had that rhythm from the very beginning. You will know pain, you will know fear, and then you will die.
Yes.
and Andreas and I kind of mapped out who would say what and how we would, you know, what beats we would hit. And, you know, people think that comedy, it's all improv or it's not rehearsed. Really good comedy, and I used to rep comics, so I know this, they know exactly what they're doing. They know how long to time the beat. They know what mannerisms to put behind it, what facial expressions, when to pause and go, yeah, you know, that whole thing. And that was what was fun about Andreas and I. We found that.
Awesome.
You had mentioned Michael O'Hare, and there's another fan question here from Monica in Denver, who asked, when you worked with Michael O'Hare, did you ever get any indication that he was struggling? What do you remember most about him?
What I remember most about Michael, because he did have a dialogue coach with him, is that because I'd seen his work on stage, I thought to myself, this is a tough transition. It's a lot of pages of dialogue. This isn't memorizing a play. Blocking in the theater piece is, if I'm going to have this cup of coffee, I pick it up every single time. You are instructed to do that in the theater. You don't deviate. It is, you might have certain nuances in how you look, or maybe you've had a difficult day. And so maybe your song sounds a little different in the musical theater or whatever. Maybe you do deliver a line just slightly different. But in order for the play to be the play for everyone all the time, your blocking is sacred.
Right.
That is not true in television. Film, sorta. But in television, it's fast. You may, for camera angles, you know, you're doing a wide shot, you're doing a medium shot, now you're coming into a two shot, now you're going to go over the shoulder, right. You're coming around, you know, all of these technical aspects for theatrical people can be overwhelming. And I think that he was so wanting to focus on his character that he didn't want to be distracted by all this technical stuff. That was my take. So he had someone with him that he could stay in character, even though you're doing it 10 times in a scene, you know, and then you've got a guest star that you don't know. So in the theater, you have this family. In television, it's next, 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 and let's get this shot, you know,
right.
Even if you'd like to take a little more time. I'm actually doing a documentary on brain health called Noise.
Yeah, yeah.
Took a hit to the head in 2015, and I had a TBI. So my perspective of healthy or unhealthy brains has changed dramatically.
Right.
So back then, what I saw was someone who was a bit overwhelmed by the technical aspects of the job and needed support.
Wonderful.
That's all I saw.
Yeah. Yeah, I did listen to the podcast where you talked about going down a rock slide, was it?
Yeah, with Jason Momoa. Uh-huh.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was kind of silly.
Mm.
And I slammed my head. It was like a waterfall on a rock in the middle of the Puerto Rican jungle.
And how is that, all of that now?
No, I have to tell you, the Amen Clinics saved my life. I am 100%. I'm better than I've ever been. I have perspective. I have calm. I have peace. I still feel all the emotions, but I supplement my diet with GABA and taurine, different things for calmness and focus and things that help improve the acuity of my brain. The fact that I got hit by a car July 1st, 2020, and I just placed third in a race on a year later. For a triathlon, it's mental toughness. And that's why I look at people who have issues with anxiety, because I had it. Racing thoughts, I had it. Automatic negative thinking, I had it. Insomnia, had it. Depression, had it. I went, oh my God, everybody's walking around. It's like having a bad heart. The problem is we don't say, gee, you know, your brain's not functioning the way you want. Let's work on it. We go, oh my God, you have mental illness. Oh my God. You know, and put them on a pill.
Right.
You know, so I'm a huge advocate of a natural way of healing, hyperbaric chamber, transcranial magnetic stimulation, supplements, diet, workout, and talk therapy. If you need more than that, go for it. If you need something to help you with more severe issues, absolutely. We're not going to tell you you're a bad person because you're taking, you know, steroids for your heart. You shouldn't do that to you if you've got an issue with your brain.
All right. So are we still doing fan questions or do we want
to?
Okay.
No, I haven't.
I'm dying to ask stuff, but I don't want to, I don't want to jump ahead.
No. Other than these kinds of podcasts or Zooms or Instagram lives that I do, I don't think I've appeared since 2014. I think that was my last appearance with the cast, and that was in Phoenix. And we had just lost a few more people, and they ran that memorial, and it was like, oh my God, you know. So I'm happy to answer fans' questions. You know, I don't do conventions where I'm, although it is fun sometimes when I'm telling them what to do, and I go, you just got yelled at by Natal, and they go, oh.
I feel so privileged. All right. So the next question is going to come from Susan. She is in Sacramento, California.
That's my mom.
So as an actress, do you feel differently? How do you feel about playing Natal versus playing the lawyer? And are there advantages or disadvantages to each?
Well, the lawyer was like a Spencer Tracy routine. You know, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to work with Bruce, which was fabulous. I love Bruce Boxleitner. I've always liked his work. Playing Natoth, again, we talked about you know, how you have to work doing mask work and how you over accentuate. What was great about playing Guinevere Corey, written by the wonderful Peter David, is that Guinevere still had that same energy like Natoff. She was kind of taking the piss out of Boxleitner, you know? But she did it in a way that she didn't have to be strident or in his face. She was just incredibly confident. You know,
yeah.
She was just like, no, I don't think so. You're in trouble. You're in big trouble and you need me, you know? And I love that character. We just had, they cut some of the best stuff though. We had some really funny repartee that I wish they would have kept in, but for time they had to cut it. So I was very, very sad when they took the show a different direction and my character didn't get to stay on, because Joe had talked to me about being a recurring as Guinevere, which would have been fun.
Yeah, that would have been great. Cool. Oh, man. I actually met Bruce just a month ago at Silicon. And it was...
You were there. I was there. But I got... I was passing a kidney stone. I was in the ER for 7 hours.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I didn't even get to the floor. 8:30 in the morning, I went, what the hell is this? And one of my staff, who's also an EMT, said, I think you're passing a kidney stone. So off I went to the hospital.
Oh, my God.
I came back on Sunday and Bruce goes, no, you don't get to die. No more.
He's very sensitive about that. Yeah. Very sensitive. I was so shocked. He spoke to my mother and I for an hour, which blew me away. I expected, you know, a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
And because we came up about Babylon 5, he sort of had to stand at the side while he's signing autographs and he's talking to us in between.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never expected an hour of time. So that's, I agree with you. He's just a wonderful guy.
Yeah. Wonderful actor too.
Another guy of yours was there, which was Mark Shepard.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys that you represent, and something that we kind of wanted to move into and talk to you about.
Yeah.
I listened to the Look Who Showed Up podcast, which you were on not too long ago. Yeah. And you had talked about having a back brace and your self-image. And since then, you've become the CEO of Illumina. You're a recording artist, a triathlete, and a motivational speaker and life coach. So to those who are listening and struggle with their own self-image or feelings of self-worth, what advice can you give, having come out so well from your circumstances?
Well, thank you. Here's the funny thing. I believe whatever challenge you're born with, and mine happened to be a curved spine, and it was bad. I was 5'1 at 10, and I was 5'8.5 by the time I was 12. And the curve was getting bad. And they just looked at me and said, if you don't wear this, you're going to be crippled by the time you're 25. Mm. And I went, okay. But everyone wanted to make me broken. And I said, I'm not broken. I'm just different. And we're fixing it. It's going to be fine. And so I ended up still swimming on the swim team and playing basketball, because they would let me take the brace off. I wore it 23 hours a day. So it was up to my neck, down past my bottom. It was a metal girdle. It was two bars on the back. It was a metal ring up here. It's called a Milwaukee brace. It was a 2-inch block of wood pushing into one side of my spine. It was a leather girdle, a leather pad pushing on the other side to make, think about braces to make me straight. And then it was a leather girdle with plastic that pulled my hips down.
Sounds comfortable.
It was fabulous. We didn't call it bullying then. We just said you were getting picked on.
Yeah.
My music saved me, because I was a competitive singer. I was in all the choirs and I National School Choral Award and all that stuff. I didn't have a lot of friends, but I had my music and I had my sports, and I knew that this wasn't going to last forever. So when I talk to people who have chronic illness, I have some wonderful people in my life who are dealing with, you know, they're now in wheelchairs. My wonderful client, Tim Omundson, from Psych and Supernatural and Gallivant. Tim had a stroke 5 years ago. And I was so proud of him. He got on stage recently with Misha Collins from Supernatural at the, which show, where were we? We were at Salt Lake City. And the crowd of 4,000 just went crazy. And, you know, this is a man who, you know, has worked in rehabilitating himself for years. So you don't give up. You don't quit. You find your best you. If you keep telling yourself that story, that's what your life will be. But if you say, huh, I woke up this morning, most of my body's functioning, let me go find some things to appreciate, and ask yourself to challenge one thing that you can do that only you can do, whether it's something in the arts or something in, you know, I have some people that are fantastic gardeners, you know, or they make things. Anything you can do that allows you to express yourself will help you to have better self-esteem and better self-care, better self-love. And quite frankly, the people that talk down to you or make you feel bad, flee those people. I don't care if it's even your family of origin. Go make a new family. It's that simple, but it's also really hard. But you can do it, you know. I'm a living testimony to having several things go wrong, especially lately. But you just get up. Get up. Just get up.
So beautiful. I was just struck by you were talking about that. And then Dan and I were just silent because I think there's so much truth in what you said. And you are an inspiring woman. And I'm just, wow, you're amazing. So you touched a little bit on your music. I did have some questions about that. Okay. I listened to your albums. My favorite one is Struck by Lightning. It's a mood. Like, I want to listen to it in the dark, glass of wine, raining outside. It's like the perfect mood for that, I think. Yeah. But I was really struck by how different and varied each album sort of seemed to draw from different inspirations. And I'm curious about what inspires you musically, and where you draw from.
Well, it's always from my life. It's always me needing to work something out psychically, spiritually, emotionally. The first album, Shedding My Skin, which was the joke about, you know, being a lizard, was an angry album. There was a lot of anger in that album. There was songs about divorce in that album. There were things about my life, my family. And then my spiritual awakening a little bit in that. But Struck by Lightning was written at a period where I was starring on Broadway. I did one audition and I got the lead in a Broadway musical. And I was working with manifestation. I was working with visualization. And so Struck by Lightning was a happier album in a lot of ways. It was an album where I said, okay, you may not have control of everything, but you can control your second thought. The first one might come out of, you know, your social conditioning or your neural pathway. But if you have a healthy brain, you can stop and go, whoa, whoa, wait, I don't really want to work that up into a lather. I'd rather go this way. The third album, Love Is Like the Rain.
My favorite.
Here's the funny thing. I didn't write. The second album was in 2000. I didn't write for 14 years.
Wow.
And it wasn't that I stopped playing so much. It was more that I was building the company, and then I had another baby and I had a ruptured appendix and I almost died. And I started writing more. I started doing more theatrical writing. So my outlet changed, right? Mm-hmm. But when I came back to writing, it was because I had started dating and I was on Bumble. And I was meeting all these people and I went, oh my God.
Yeah.
So, you know, for a while was all about, you know, it's a country ballad. It was all about, you know, this is who I am. You know, I'm in my 50s. This is it. Take me for what I am and make me understand you for a while. You know, a while could be 2 days. It could be 2 years, it could be 20 years, you know. But my son was a huge inspiration for Brick and The Light in the Dark. Those are two poems of his.
Oh, wow.
So awesome. Brick is a poem he wrote at 12. And at, like, I think, 6 months later, he wrote a haiku called The Light in the Dark. And I was just so inspired that I wrote the music to that. I'd like to regret this, was kind of like getting all these men to lighten the hell up. Like, I'm just scratching an itch, man. You know, not trying to be a wife, not trying to marry you. Calm down. But I'd like to wake up in the morning and regret this. Thank you very much. And then Love Is Like the Rain was because I had been listening to some Sondheim. And one of the things that I, one of the plays that I saw, one of my first musicals that I ever saw on Broadway was Sunday in the Park with George, about George Seurat, the pointillist. And there's a couple of songs that there that made me go, oh, you know. And I had dated this guy, and he was just terrified. He was terrified of commitment. He was terrified of making a wrong move. And I'm like, Love Is Like the Rain. Just get wet, man. Just let it come down. Just enjoy it, you know? And
there's a metaphor for you.
Breath, you know? Jump. And so the songs, I love all disciplines. I grew up singing church music. I started in Latin high masses at 10, and then I did the folk group, and then I started singing jazz choirs. Then I went into my own cabaret show and singer-songwriter stuff, and then Broadway stuff. So I have played with some great musicians. I wish I was a better musician. Now that my hand's kind of jacked up, I actually want to go study lead so I can strengthen my fingers again, because it still feels like I'm in cement in this hand.
Yeah, you said there's metal in your hand?
Yeah, I have three metal plates in this hand.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah. So this finger is just, it's just weak. It just, I can't do bar chords with this finger. And so I think if I learn some lead, I think it'll strengthen me.
Mm, become a new Django Reinhardt.
Yeah. Bonnie Raitt. Okay.
Yeah. Well, not just playing the guitar, but I'll tell you, I didn't know what to expect. A lot of celebrities make music and whatnot. You go and you listen to it, you're like, yeah. And I clicked play and I went, oh my God, this woman has a set of pipes.
Oh, thank you.
You know what? I was very pleasantly surprised and absolutely love it. And the Light in the Dark, I told you before we started recording this, that's probably one of my favorites. Just the whole mood and everything to it. It's just magical.
Doesn't it sound like the soundtrack for like some spaghetti Western or something? I mean, the horns and we just had some, I mean, that flamenco guitar, that's me playing that.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That's so amazing. I play rhythm on the album, and I've got great buddies, Dave Maros and other guys that play the Rich Mauser played the bass and lead guitars, but we had some very talented string musicians. I had a full set, man. I mean, like, I flew, there was a guy that played dobro and mandolin and lap steel on my first record. And so I said, oh man, I need dobro and shit on this for a while. And so we sent the tracks over to him. He was performing in Germany and he recorded. I mean, this is the technology. It's like,
yeah,
lay down some tracks for me, man. And he did. That's great.
Awesome. So you have written books, you've recorded music. If somebody wants to get a hold of these things, where should they go? I know you have your website, juliecaitlinwhite.com.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do.
We discovered.
But we, because of the pandemic and because the core business, you know, took a dive, about 90% of my income went away. I was in the middle of doing the documentary on brain health, which I was financing, and a Broadway musical based on the music of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And something had to give. So I'm going to move the entire website to a new platform and get it all back up and going. The first two albums, I do have hard copies of that, because what most people don't use CDs anymore. Right now I would say it's www.juliecaitlinbrown.com. You can still message me.
Okay.
And if you're interested, as I start to see people being interested in downloading the tracks and all of that stuff, I will make a call to my web person and say, okay, we're moving this. We're going to get it somewhere where it's really functional. I'll come out on my Instagram and do a live, or let you know, and you can let your listeners know that, hey, it's ready to download again.
Smart way to do it. Demand. Yeah.
Demand. Yeah.
We actually, there's a burning question that's probably on everybody's mind.
Okay.
And yes! You know this because the big news dropped that JMS is now going to be heading a reboot of Babylon 5 on the CW.
And one of our fans had asked a question. Which one was it? Let's see here. It was actually a previous guest on this show, another actor, Jeffrey Weissman, who was...
Hi, Jeff. Yes.
Do you know Jeffrey?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm.
He asked what your thoughts on the reboot were.
Well, here's what I think. I don't think Joe got to tell the story in the manner in which he wanted to tell it. I think there's a lot of story left to tell. I think that it would be nice if they would do what Battlestar Galactica did, which is if they want to recast it and reimagine it from the beginning, right? That they take a lot of us who used to be on the show and put us in appropriate ways, right? Mm-hmm. Either new characters or characters that make sense. If they decide to make it something where they pick up where the show ended, see, I have no idea what they're doing. That gives you more opportunity to bring people back from the original series because it's a continuation, like they did with Picard.
Right.
So think about Picard. You know, you have all these spinoffs, and then all of a sudden you've got Picard, and it's just him. You know, and then all of a sudden Jerry Ryan comes back, and different people come back in. So it could be imagined that way. I loved working with everybody. I would love to do that again. There's only 8 of us that were considered series regulars that are left. And I think Joe deserves that opportunity. I think he's a talented man, and I'm not kissing ass here. He knows I feel this way. Mm-hmm. I think that he was struggling with UPN and then with the Ted Turner Network to really have his vision honored, and I'm extremely excited for him that he's now in a place in his life and his career where he can focus on this one more time and do it the way he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm behind him 100%. I just finished reading Becoming Superman, his book, and that man went through a lot to get where he is. There's a success story right there. And what he did with Babylon 5 is it's groundbreaking. Earth changing, in my opinion. It obviously had a huge impact on me, Tanya as well.
Yeah.
And some of my favorite things have come out of it. This last year has actually been amazing, believe it or not, coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah.
It was so dark, you know, it was struggling to find meaning. I came up with the podcast idea because I was listening to them at work because I needed headphones. So I decided to just listen to podcasts and decided this is what I'm going to do. What knowledge do I have? I don't really know anything. Oh, I know pop culture. I know TV and movies. So,
yeah. You know.
And then I've just been very fortunate, put it all out there. Every person I've approached to be on the show has said yes. And I just asked. But getting to do Babylon 5 would be, I would say, is one of the big goals for me because this was something that was very transformative, almost like music in a sense.
Yeah.
And I know you understand this, and this is why I get where you're coming from when you say that music was transformative for you. Music saved my life. I can't tell you how many times. And Babylon 5 in this point in time is now giving me some new meaning because I get to experience more and more of it. Yeah. I really hope that they get you on the new one. I think that'd be fantastic. I'm pulling for
you. We'll see. I haven't gotten a phone call yet, but you never know. I mean, I think it was hard when I had to tell Joe because they called me. And they're like, you're not going to do it. And I said, I just don't see how I can for the kind of money they want to pay me. After I pay everybody, I'm making so little compared to people that don't have prosthetics on. And the work is incredibly hard.
Right.
But, you know, I love the part and let's see what we can do. And I very much was very happy that Joe did write me another character and then brought me back. And there's tremendous love and respect there with me and him. And I think that the world has changed in terms of CGI and prosthetic makeup and the understanding of what it takes to bring those characters to life. So I'm hoping that this iteration of Babylon 5 will see, I mean, they were very innovative. Doug Netter, all of that photography, everything that he did was so innovative. He was so excited about it. And I remember when I got the show, he goes, you got to come into the computer room because I'm going to show you how we make it all happen. You know, he was so excited. Their lighting techniques, everything they did was brilliant. And so their costume designers were great. So I think now with all the advancements in this type of filming, it's going to be extraordinary on a technological level.
Yeah.
And then marry that to his storytelling. Get out of town. We're going to
have forget about it.
Forget about it. Good.
Oh, man. Well, really, I don't know that we have a whole lot else question-wise. Did you have something else you want to talk about, Tanya?
Actually, just, well, oh, it's 3:30.
Yeah, we kind of got
No, I'm okay.
All right. We are humbled and so gracious, grateful that you were gracious enough to come on and do this with us. We're the little podcast that could here. And we're just very happy to have been able to speak to you.
Yeah. Thank you for being so generous with your time. We really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. You know, I look for reasons to wash my hair today. No, I'm kidding. Because of the triathlete stuff, I'm always swimming or something. And it's like, oh, I get to dress up. Cool. Oh, no, cool. I really love talking to you. You're very well informed. You're very professional. It's been a pleasure. I hope that something I said, you know, if somebody is struggling out there, just know that it does get better, but you got to keep showing up. If you quit, well, then you're done, you know? True. So much love to you all. Please let me know how I can support you. If there's anybody you're trying to reach, you know,
and likewise, if you want to promote shows, anything you want to promote, we will plug for you. If you want to put a show together here with one of your actors or something, we will tailor it to you. Okay.
Awesome. So they need to do more in Sacramento, by the way, too. We had Sac Anime and stuff like that. And just gosh, you know, it's just gone. So we'll see what we can do.
Beautiful.
All right, my friend.
I let me take away a little of the professionalism for a second. All right. Thank you,
Julie. That's right,
baby. All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Bye. Have a great day.
You too.
Both within one another. Searching for the truth. Searching for the truth. The truth. Hidden away.